Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
This is Pete.
Nope, I'm Pete. That's Ben.
That is always how we've done it.
You've never said...
I've always said, that's Pete.
I'm Pete. No, that does not feel right. We've never done that before. Listen, I know you do the editing.
Yeah.
I know you listen to this 100 times. We've never done it that way.
All right. And this is the Henson Perspective, where we look back at the 45 years of yawning, gaping distance between the original New York broadcast of an episode of The Muppet Show, and we compare it to today and try to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and what never worked. 45 years ago today, it was December 6th, 1976, and the Bruce Forsyth episode aired in New York, the 13th production episode. Pete, you asked me at the very beginning of the season whether or not any episodes were the same in production order and broadcast order.
Mm-hmm.
This is the closest.
Closest. Still not right.
Still not right. And there may be another one to come as the season continues, but I think that this production 13, episode 12 will be the closest we'll get over the whole series.
I have a feeling, so I just pulled this up on the Wikia.
Yeah.
I think there were reshoots on this episode and there's no information, because according to that, the production dates were July 27th and 28th and then again on August 5th.
Yeah, I didn't have that information.
I have no notes. This is pure speculation on this. There's no other information provided by the Wikia about it. But I don't think we've ever seen a break like that in filming.
August 5th, you say?
I do.
Well, let's do some bad flipping noises. So, what's production episode 14? I think it's pretty early.
14 is Sandy Duncan.
That's it.
August 3rd and through 5th. So they shot some of Sandy Duncan and Bruce on the same day, according to the Wikia.
The question is, then, did they have extra stuff that they used to insert into it, or did they do deliberate reshoots?
And was Bruce Forsyth even in those reshoots? Probably not, since it was
almost
a week later.
Almost certainly not. The question is, was there stuff that they decided not to use, or did they end up with not enough stuff? Was it a reshoot, or was it a re-edit?
I'm going to go out on a limb and call a shot here.
Hit.
I bet they had so much fun with the heckling, they redid the backstage stuff to have that be the runner.
There are two runners in the backstage episode.
Mm-hmm.
The second is, or the first, I should say, because it's introduced first, is more subtle. It's the long chain of the duck character that comes up and says,
I finally got the punchline down for the act tonight.
And then it takes forever for that line to actually show up.
But the duck keeps showing up.
Correct.
And so you keep thinking, oh, this is going to be where the duck has the punchline.
Mm-hmm. But the other one being, as you say, the runner where Fozzie is preparing to be able to respond to the hecklers.
Yep. No proof. None.
Hmm.
Just pure speculation. Anyway, since we've already talked about two of the runners, we should probably start talking about the episode.
So let's go through the non-Bruce Forsyth segments of the show, and then you'll introduce me to what I need to know and what our audience needs to know about Bruce Forsyth, and then we'll talk about his segments before closing out the episode.
With statistics and then our top five moments.
The introduction begins with Kermit in an uncharacteristically nonchalant introduction of the concept of Bruce Forsyth. He gets more excited once we come back from the titles, but, well, Plano doesn't shout.
Yeah.
He sort of blithely says,
Mr. Bruce Forsyth!
Fozzie comes out and does a joke that is, he even frames it as a thinker.
Yeah, he says, if a man born in
Poland is a Pole, is a man born in Holland a hole? Think about it.
At first I was kind of offended by the think about it. I didn't think it was necessary. And then, actually, I think it was.
Yeah,
I think that I would have been so taken aback by the weird implications of the word whole, thinking about what resonance that might have, that I wouldn't have gone back to the grammatical structure that led him to that punchline.
Yeah, he needed either that line or then to make like an over-exaggerated, like, put his hand in his chin, like, yeah, thinker pose, which is appropriate with our guest today, which I may or may not get into later.
And finally, when Gonzo is about to hit the O in the Muppet Show sign, he actually hits it to the sound of shattering glass, and it fragments.
Mm-hmm. And if you look really closely, before he hits it, you can actually see the pre-cut of it.
I missed that.
When I watched it a second time. And you'll get a chance to see that as well, because it's new to us this time, but it's reused from the second episode of production order.
Hmm.
So we'll see it again. Then Kermit introduces the show.
And here he's much more exuberant about the fact that Bruce Forsyth is coming out. You're smirking because I still couldn't quite get his name right.
Yep.
But we will talk more about that when we're doing the Forsyth segments. Mm. But he's there to introduce a, not Kuzbanian, but it's definitely an alien species called the Snurfs. Not to be confused with somebody who's Belgian and three apples high. The Snurfs are fuzzy, bird-like things with horns for beaks, and they play along to a song called In a Little Spanish Town that has, not dueling, but conversational trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that the horns were a little more animated or expressive, because
the horns themselves, not the Snurfs.
Not the, okay. No, the Snurfs. The Snurfs have air horns as beaks.
Right.
But they don't move. And so the fact that one of the two Snurfs that comes out is talking with one of the sets of horns in the original music, and one is the contrasting conversational horns. I would have been more able to associate them with their voices, as it were.
Or if you could individualize them.
That's right.
But then that doesn't work with the rest of the sketch.
Right. Because once more Snurfs come on the screen, which very quickly do, after the first verse of this piece, the one Snurf goes off screen and comes back with three additional Snurfs. And then it wouldn't be a one-to-one conversation, and so that role would have gotten confusing.
Then once those five do a little dance, then for the third verse, they all walk off screen, and then there's 20 of them right on stage. My note is good heightening, because the Snurfs also grow and shrink in height the entire time.
Mm-hmm. I loved this sketch.
Yeah, it was great. I just looked at Snurfs because they are clickable, and apparently Ideal Toys created the first licensed Muppet dolls. The three characters they chose were Kermit, Ralph, and Snurf.
Wow.
But there's no proof that the Snurf puppet was ever actually manufactured and sold. But it is one of the earliest Muppets that Henson created, apparently.
The Snurf puppet is listed in the trivia track as being designed in 1965. But I didn't find any particular evidence that this was a performance that they'd done on Sullivan or Parr or any of those. It has the feel of that kind of act that we've seen other very non-human Muppets do, where they're basically dancing along to an orchestral or a jazz piece. You're looking at the wiki. Has anything come up to A Little Spanish Town as being done previously?
No other. Oh, wait. Nope. Found it.
Okay.
A chorus of Snurfs performed in A Little Spanish Town in the Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass special in 1974.
That makes sense. I can definitely hear the Tijuana Brass performing this song.
Yeah. The uh-oh that I just realized is, so in the second verse, one of the two beginning Snurfs is kind of being bullied by the other Snurfs.
Yes.
And at one point, that Snurf gets short, rolls around, and gets jumped on by other Snurfs. Didn't count these as hits. Do I count jumping on as a hit? Because as we've discussed, stomping counts. But this isn't a stomp, it's jumping on.
Look, I never know how to answer these questions. The fact that I'm contributing to your stats by saying yes or no makes me feel like I have outsized amounts of power here. My guess is no.
Good, because I don't remember how many jumps there were.
With the off-the-top-of-my-head rationale that because the Snurfs are flying, they can't be full-force hits as they sort of flutter down and land on the bullied Snurf.
Excellent. Excellent. I like that.
Statler and Waldorf
had
an interesting tone in responding to this. They were both positive and dismissive because Waldorf says,
"Now I've seen everything. Good, can we leave?"
Yeah, it wasn't mad about "now I've seen everything." It was like, "Oh, that was enjoyable."
But Statler very quickly takes it as, "Thank goodness we're done with the Muppet Show."
Yeah.
Too bad. If they'd only taken advantage of that, Fozzie could have had a much easier day.
Yeah, it's true.
Which is where we go from here, because from Statler and Waldorf, we go backstage with the Snurfs coming from the stage and being complimented by
Kermit,
who says, "Good job, Snurfs," very casually, whereas when he introduced them, he said Snurfs like he'd never heard the word before.
"But right now, let's kick things off with a new musical group we call the Snurfs." These Snurfs?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some inconsistencies in this episode.
And then a duck comes on to say that she has been working on her punchline.
And the duck gives away the punchline and says, "Quack," quite emphatically. And then Kermit is dismissive of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the duck hits back at Kermit by saying, "Sure, Toad."
And walks off muttering to herself. The duck is played by Cynthia Adler. This is her second and final appearance on The Muppet Show, after having been Cynthia Birdsley in the talk spot. As I said at the time, we don't really know why she left, and there hasn't been any interviews about it. She's good as the duck, and the duck is in this episode a lot. To have gone from being two parts in the previous episode, as maybe having been the Svengali's assistant, and having been Cynthia Birdsley, and now to have been one of the two runners in this, and pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I like the duck a lot.
Whatever happened means we never got any more of Ms. Adler.
But after the duck leaves, Fozzie comes in and says that he's ready for Statler and Waldorf tonight.
Fozzie asks if he can practice responding to a heckle on Kermit.
So Kermit says yes. Fozzie tells a misogynistic joke. Kermit then boos him, rightly so. Boos him, tells him he's the worst. Fozzie then takes off his hat, immediately gets on his knees and hugs Kermit and says,
"Oh, please don't heckle me."
To which Kermit rightly says, "Fozzie, is this an example of your razor-like wit?"
Oh, it made me laugh so hard. Because it's exactly what I would do.
I was going to say, it's not that great of a joke. It's better than the next one. The next one is a successful piece of escalation, but I didn't laugh at it.
Yeah, where this is, it's good puppeteering, and it's such a good subversion, because he builds it up by saying, "I'm gonna get him, just watch me get him," and then it's just, "Oh, please don't heckle me."
I love what Oz is doing with his voice.
Yep.
He makes him so pathetic.
Mm-hmm. So then Kermit introduces Bruce, so we will come back to that sketch later.
And Statler and Waldorf's comment is also very Forsythe specific.
Yep. So shall we do that later, or shall we just say they like what Forsythe did?
Unless we want to talk about the final bit that they're sort of going at each other, that Statler doesn't get the joke, and Waldorf pretty much calls him an idiot. He says,
"Statler, you must be the old fool there's no fool like."
Which was grammatically confusing.
Yeah, I didn't get that part. I mean, I understood the concept, but I didn't get the quote-unquote joke.
There's an adage, there's no fool like an old fool. And by saying, "You're the old fool there's no fool like," is supposed to get you to recall that. But it is a curly-Q sentence that if you're not immediately familiar with that adage, you're not going to pull it out of thin air.
Got it.
It's also, I don't know how common of a phrase that is. Maybe in 1976?
Yeah, no clue.
Whereas I more flashed on to Ben Kenobi getting out of the storage lockers in the Millennium Falcon saying, "Who's the greater fool, the fool or the fool who follows him?" A year later, 1977.
Yep.
"You must be the old fool there's no fool like," Han Solo. But more appropriately, we get to the second backstage Fozzie moment where he, in fact, does the thing that I don't find particularly funny.
Yeah, he's ready for the comeback this time. The joke he tells is, my cousin is so dumb he thinks Eggs Benedict is a mafia gangster.
A redundant phrase that struck me as deeply bizarre, that somebody noted this and said, I don't think Eggs Benedict is going to sound like a mafioso unless we use both those words.
Yeah, especially considering The Godfather had come out at this point as well. Like, if this was pre-Godfather, I'd say, okay, maybe mafia is a specific reference or something like that. So the heartland may not know exactly what it is.
I was also wondering whether this was more England than America.
Yeah.
I don't have any way of saying it one way or another, but somebody definitely said we need both words in order to create a successful context, and it just made it awkward.
Kermit's response is, I've seen cheeseburgers funnier than that. And then Fozzie hits him with a rubber chicken.
That's right.
Our first hit of the episode since we aren't counting the jumps.
And then says, am I being too subtle?
Also, how did he think that he couldn't do that to Statler and Waldorf because they're in the box? What's he going to be like, wait right there. And just run over, climb up, whack him on the head with the rubber chicken and climb back down?
You're right. It doesn't work. Like I said, it is an escalation from pleading for mercy. And it is going too far. But somehow, it didn't strike me as either practical or what Fozzie would have come up with.
Except for the fact that a rubber chicken is a tried and true hacky joke. And so that falls in line with Fozzie's general vibe.
Right. It does feel like the kind of goofy comic object that he would have.
Well, after that, we go to the dance and Pogo George watch. Slight pogoing.
Basically not.
Yeah, not really pogoing, but they're also not tangoing either. Mm-hmm. So it's weird. Mildred and George are dancing. Mildred invites George to dinner and then asks, do you like duckling? George says, I don't know. I've never duckled.
The trivia track wants to point out that this is a running gag from a previous episode.
Oh.
So we will see this joke again in the Charles Aznavour episode.
Okay. So, pausing here, there's no duck in this, but because of the duck from earlier, I expected the duck to show up after this.
Right. Duckling.
Yeah. The second bit is between
Zoot,
yes, and Janice.
Mm-hmm. Janice starts off by asking Zoot if he knows what happened in 1776.
No, baby, but there's a great party in 1342.
The third joke is two pigs, Piggy and a generic pig, talking about U.S. history.
Piggy says, I'm really into American history, Washington, Jefferson, Revere. And then the male pig says, oh, do you like Franklin? And Piggy says, I don't know, I've never Frankled.
I really enjoy that structure of the joke. I'm really hoping I'm quick enough that I'm able to work this into my own annoying vocabulary.
Great.
Probably won't happen. I need to sit down with a list of vocab that ends with an ing so that then I can turn it into a gerund instead of a noun.
And then I have to learn to not fall for answering that question.
Right.
Yeah.
After the ad break, we get back from the UK spot and we get I'm My Own Grandpa is performed by the Gogolala Jubilee Jug Band.
I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa.
What's your acquaintance with this song?
I've heard it a bunch of times. Don't remember where I first encountered it, whether it was here or someplace else, but I very much enjoy this song. Like, in the, I forget what the other wordplay song. Oh, the Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I like wordplay songs. Mm-hmm. They're fun to follow and try and see if the logic makes sense. And the Gogolala Jubilee Jug Band are interesting enough characters to watch that just having them stand there and perform while these nonsense words are happening, it's fun.
So, I want to pitch a couple of punch-ups on this sketch to you and see what you think about them.
Okay.
There are a bunch of different versions of this song. One of the earlier ones I found was by a group called Lonzo and Oscar in 1947. There was one also done by a group called Homer and Jethro in 1956. I wasn't quite sure which one of those was probably the one that Henson & Associates got familiar with as a comic record. neither one is a exact match in terms of the arrangement that Jack Parnell put together for this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a country singer who's performed this song a number of times since the 90s. He doesn't sing the chorus in the middle, which makes sense because I'm My Own Grandpa is the conclusion to the end of the second verse.
For now I have become the strangest case you ever saw. As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa.
By doing the chorus in between the first and second verses, you're giving it away.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the way in which he does it and that he performs it as somebody who is confused and surprised by these discoveries and family relations as they are, he explains them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that structurally, that's great. The Lonzo and Oscar version starts with the chorus, does a verse, repeats the chorus, does a verse, repeats the chorus. You're never not aware of what the conclusion is going to be. And it did occur to me, I wondered if this would be funnier, but less peppy, if you only had the chorus at the very end.
Yeah, never having heard that version, I have no idea what it sounds like with verse, verse, chorus, verse.
It only occurred to me when I was trying to learn the lyrics a number of years ago, and I realized, oh, he hasn't actually explained how he's his own grandpa in the middle of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's singing it in advance of having reached that point.
Uh-huh.
I encourage anybody who's interested to check out the Wikipedia entry on this song, as it talks about its historical roots, that the original writers put it together after encountering an article in a Mark Twain anthology that he wrote and published in 1883, and that may or may not have been based on an actual historical occurrence that showed up in newspapers periodically for 30 to 50 years before that.
Wow.
So this song has deep roots.
After the... Oh, there is an audience shot as well.
Very strange audience shot.
Yeah, this is weird because they go to the audience and then they come back to them as they're running around on stage, being confused as to how to get off stage, kind of.
Uh-huh. Doesn't make any sense, except for, as you point out, that there may have been reshoots on this. It's an unnecessary couple of seconds, but maybe you needed a couple of unnecessary seconds if you'd chopped a bunch of this episode out.
Mm. Yeah, it's weird. Then we have the talk spot with our special guest, so we will return to that later. I guess we kind of have to talk about Statler and Waldorf again after that, because it has direct references to it.
Well, it's mostly them talking about Miss Piggy's behavior and excitability, which I think we can talk about in the general sense.
Fair.
Waldorf says that Miss Piggy sure takes umbrage with the slightest annoyance.
And then
Statler says,
oh, I usually take aspirin. Maybe I'll try some umbrage.
Which, the reason I mentioned earlier that Waldorf was getting kind of annoyed at Statler is that two of the major Statler and Waldorf blackouts that we get in this, as opposed to when they come back later in the Fozzie bit, Statler's being real dumb. Like, Statler's, his point in this episode is to not get the jokes.
Mm-hmm. They're more mad at each other than they are at the show this week.
Correct.
Yeah. Then we go backstage again.
Mm-hmm.
Fozzie is practicing his comebacks. He's got a little sheet of paper and he's kind of muttering to himself, trying to memorize them, I guess. And then Kermit enters and tells him that he doesn't need to worry about his heckling comebacks.
The show's running long and your act's been cut.
This is the first time I think we've gotten Oz from the laugh track. The audience is upset that Fozzie will not be doing his act this week.
I also noticed that. My first reaction was, that's a strange thing for the crew to do. And then I realized, wait, no, this is just plain old laugh track.
Yep. Then Hilda enters and Fozzie asks for her to stand there so she can break his fall when he faints from hearing this news. Then he falls backwards instead of towards her.
Right. She's definitely not standing in a place that would be useful to him.
And then the duck enters. And so we're gonna get our punchline right then.
But no, the duck says,
Cute faint.
Logged it.
Would you have at this point started to have picked up on the recurring cutes bits?
I think at this point, yes, because we've had so many in such a short time. We had two last week. We have two this week. Mm-hmm. Spoilers. And I think we didn't have any the week before, but I think we had another one or two the episode before that, too.
It's starting to almost become not funny anymore because...
Disagree.
Oh, interesting. All right.
I'm in at this point.
For whatever reason, it didn't really work for me with the duck.
See, I loved it because
you were expecting the quack.
Anytime the duck shows up this episode, I'm like, oh, here we go. This is the punchline, even though it doesn't make sense right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for that subversion, again, I'm into it.
I get that. That didn't occur to me. Therefore, I wasn't. I was mostly concentrating on the delivery. I think Adler's got her work cut out for her in doing the duck voice, which can't be easy.
Mm.
And I thought that Goals did a much better job with the timing of it when he does it later.
Got it.
I'll just say, in both this and the next bit, why is Hilda coming from on stage?
Well, is it on stage, or might there be like another little wing that she's waiting on as the costumer where she needs to be right off stage to help dress and undress people?
Yeah. We have seen her stand in the wings to watch Fozzie on stage, so maybe she just enjoys standing right off stage in order to see the on stage action.
Yeah.
That would make a certain degree of sense. I only thought of it when, and I am jumping ahead, when Gonzo, in his cute fall bit next, is going on stage but doesn't have an act.
Yeah.
I felt cheated that we didn't get a Gonzo bit except for that one line in this episode.
Well, Ben, this might go, I don't know if it's towards or against your theory about the stage show versus the televised show, that there might be acts that are being done for the quote-unquote live Muppet audience
that we don't see
because that's not part of the Muppet show that is televised to our homes.
Yeah, I actually do believe that. I believe that there are acts going on stage all the time that the Muppet audience is watching that we don't actually get to see, because otherwise the show doesn't make any sense.
Right, otherwise there's 3 minutes of content per episode.
Correct.
So this might be the convergence of our two theories, actually. Well, speaking of onstage acts,
yes.
Sam then comes on to introduce Wayne and Wanda, the two solid citizens of song.
It is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you those two solid citizens of song, Wayne and Wanda, decent, decent people.
Which I thought was an odd introduction, and I couldn't figure out why, until I saw in the trivia track that this appears on the Muppet Show album. And I went to go listen to it, and he has a completely different introduction for them on that track.
Really?
On the record. Yes. He says,
besides being tremendous singers, they're church people.
Weird.
Well, then they perform a song called Trees, I guess, or a poem or something.
Yes, it is based on a poem by Joyce Kilmer. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. You're staring at me like
no,
you've never
I don't know poetry.
Okay, fair enough. I actually know of it more because of a, and I'm now going to say the name of another poet, and you're going to stare blankly at me, an Ogden Nash satirical take.
I know that name.
Okay. Ogden Nash, very funny satirical poet, did a very quick version of this, which is, I think that I shall never see a billboard lovely as a tree. Indeed, unless the billboards fall, I'll never see a tree at all.
Okay.
Which I think of every time I'm in Vermont and I realize there are no billboards because of their anti-billboard law.
I mean, no child has ever been murdered in Vermont and a mother has never been mad enough at the police to put up 3 billboards.
I was wondering where that was going because I'm sure the first sentence isn't true. Yeah, fairly famous Joyce Kilmer poem, and apparently has been set to music at some point by a guy who, depending on whether or not my handwriting is accurate, is named Oscar Rambach.
So yeah, they get through that first line or two of the poem when a tree in the background falls on Wayne. I counted this as a hit.
I think that's fair.
Because he gets hit by this tree.
The question is, I suppose, can you attribute intent? Was the tree trying to end the song, or did it accidentally fall?
Well, Ben, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to see it hit Wayne, does it hit Wayne? Since you can't answer that, I think it counts as a hit.
And I think since you used the word hit multiple times in your definition of its timbering, then it has to count.
That was the sound of me throwing my pen against the table.
That pen's going down. It's going timber.
Pitbull's not going to be happy. Well, after the tree falls, we go backstage once again,
mm-hmm.
where Fozzie is begging Kermit to put him back in the show. People expect a stand-up comic in The Muppet Show.
Well, that's good, says Kermit, because we do have a stand-up comic. But it turns out that Fozzie is not about to be the stand-up comic that goes on stage. It is going to be Bruce Forsyth.
And then we have more ahs from the audience as Fozzie is visibly yes. upset. Fozzie calls for Hilda to come rushing to his aid.
She doesn't get there fast enough.
He faints again.
And this is where Gonzo comes in and says, cute, cute fall.
Hilda!
Cute, cute fall.
Logged it.
Good. We then have a significant chunk of Bruce Forsyth, which we will cover in due time.
Mm-hmm. Quite soon, but not yet.
Because we're basically at the end of the episode with Veterinarian's Hospital.
As you mentioned last time, Piggy always has some sort of business at the beginning. She's drinking this time, but I couldn't tell what it was. She drinking the ether from the anesthesia machine?
It was a strange metal goblet
yeah.
that I have never seen with regard to any kind of medical equipment or procedure. This one was just strange.
Just some business. Speaking of business, Rolf is cutting his nails?
Trimming the fur around his finger pads?
Yeah, but it looks like he's just trying to cut his finger off. It's pretty disturbing.
But Rolf is also playing with medical equipment, which he then, very Swedish chef-like, tosses behind him once the sketch starts.
But he looks behind him to see where it landed, where the Swedish chef just lets it happen.
Cavalierly goes, and then both nurses turn to look where it goes as well. And the duck is on the operating table.
Yes.
Or is it? Is it a duck, Pete?
Or is it a chicken?
Everybody in the operating room seems to think that they're operating on a chicken.
It's another sick chicken, they say.
Well, what have we here? Another sick chicken?
I'm not a chicken, I'm a duck.
Shall we prepare for surgery on the chicken?
Duck!
Ah!
I love the idea that Veterinarian's Hospital, which usually deals with pets and or farm animals that you want to live, has been dealing with a lot of sick chickens. I don't know, maybe this is my own prejudice against the certain value of farm animals, but chickens strike me as highly disposable.
Well, the other thing is the last time we saw Veterinarian's Hospital, it was Behemoth on the table.
That's correct.
Not an animal. So maybe they don't actually perform on animals all that often.
Worth mentally putting a little checklist in our heads in terms of what sort of stuff does show up in the operating theater.
Because, yeah, maybe they're just not good at animals.
Or maybe it's because Dr. Bob is an animal that it's Veterinarian's Hospital.
Right.
Either way, the duck is incensed at being called a chicken and loudly corrects every time she is called a chicken by yelling, duck.
And then they duck underneath the operating table.
And then come up, confused, wondering who said to duck.
Yeah, it's wild. Not only do they not recognize that the duck is a duck, they hear ducks say words.
But don't think the duck can talk.
Maybe.
Or don't think the chicken can talk.
Well, isn't there a fact that ducks don't have an echo?
I have no idea.
I'm fairly certain that's a thing.
Hmm.
So maybe because of... No, but that means if there's no echo that you could only hear it from its source. You could never be confused as to, oh, it's coming from
a
over there.
A duck could never be a ventriloquist.
Exactly. Which is shocking because my friend Zach is afraid of birds, but not ducks unless they sneak up on him.
But you can always apparently hear where a duck is coming from because it doesn't echo.
Right.
Well, that's good. That means he can continue to not be scared of ducks because they can't sneak up on him.
They have snuck up on him. That's how the...
how the caveat came into being.
Yep.
Ah, brilliant. Either way, they're mysteriously surprised that a chicken could be talking. And I think that fits in with future Muppet mythology.
Fair.
Because when we start getting regular chickens on the show, they balk.
Yep.
They do not talk.
And, I like that.
And so it would be surprising that a duck would be able to yell, or that a chicken would be able to yell duck.
Yeah. This happens twice.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the third time,
Piggy notices that a large lamp above them is about to fall and yells duck.
And Rolf doesn't fall for it that time.
Says, I'm not gonna, at which point.
The light falls, but Janice and Piggy both ducked, so it only lands on Rolf.
They pick the lamp off of him, at which point the voiceover comes in and says, Dr. Bob has had a severe blow, but tune in next time when you hear him say,
well, what kind of doctor do you think I am?
At which point we finally get the duck's line.
Which is quack, which we were already told was a line.
That's right.
But finally it makes sense. Then we have one last musical number with our special guest, so we will cruise on past that.
And really, the only thing left is the final moment after the end of the credits with Statler and Waldorf.
Where Statler says, this show brought a tear to my eye. Waldorf says, really? And Statler says, yeah, I'm sitting on a tack. But up, 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 up. So, Ben, I did some research about Bruce Forsyth. I have 5 questions to ask you and some information afterwards.
Excellent. I look forward to finding out what I don't know about Bruce Forsyth, which is pretty much everything.
Good, because I want you to not get a lot of these right.
Because you've done the stats on how many questions each of us have gotten right over the course of the season so far?
Yep. So,
how much in the lead am I?
To be revealed. So we're going to go through Bruce Forsyth's entire life.
Wow. In 5 questions.
In 5 questions. So to do that, we need to start with his birth. Bruce Forsyth's birthday is on an important date to one of us. Is it January 22nd, 1928, February 22nd, 1928, or November 30th, 1928?
Last time you did this question, the answer was November 30th, and I guessed January 22nd. I'm going to guess January 22nd.
Incorrect. February 22nd, 1928 is his birthday.
It's a good birthday.
Yeah, sure. For him. Which popular video game had a collectible character that was a penguin that had Bruce's iconic bow tie and was named after him? Is it A, Digimon, B, Neopets, or C, Pokemon?
Neopets.
Correct. Originally, it actually looked like him, but then they changed him into a penguin and kept the bow tie.
As somebody who used to have a Neopet, I do not remember this one.
Wow. Bruce Forsyth was a prolific host of game shows throughout the 70s and through the end of his career and the rest of his life. Which of these US-based game shows did Bruce not host the UK version of? Card Sharks, Family Feud, or The Price is Right?
Price is Right.
Incorrect. Family Feud he did not host. In the UK, Card Sharks was called Play Your Cards Right. Question number 4. Bruce Forsyth was awarded the Guinness Book of World Record in 2013 for longest TV career by a male entertainer. His last TV credit was in 2015 on Strictly Come Dancing. How long was Bruce Forsyth's television career? Was it 66 years? Was it 70 years? Or was it 74 years long?
74.
Correct. Now, since we went through his entire life, we must now talk about his death. 1 year after his death, Forsyth's ashes were buried under which prestigious London stage? The London Palladium, the National Theatre, or Shakespeare's Globe Theatre?
The Palladium.
That is correct. He hosted a variety show on that stage for 2 or 3 years.
That makes sense.
So, unfortunately for me, you got 3 out of 5 correct, which we might as well talk about stats now.
So we are at the halfway point in the season. This is 12th out of 24 episodes.
Yes.
And we have each hosted 6 of the trivia contests.
Yes. There have been 27 questions. We've each answered 27 questions.
Okay.
I have gotten 8 out of 27 correct.
Okay.
Prior to this episode, you had also answered 8 correct.
Oh, wow.
So you are now at 11 correct out of 27. Boo. I don't like this. Especially considering every week you've been saying, like, oh, you're doing so much better than me at the quiz. No, we've been doing equally.
Maybe I'm just happy every time you get one right because it makes me feel like I'm not the worst person at writing quizzes.
Well, some more facts about Bruce.
Please.
Because he lived a fascinating life. And also, my first fact, not about him, but about his family. Mm. His great-great-great-great-grandfather, William Forsyth, was a founder of the Royal Horticultural Society and is the namesake of the planet genus Forsythius.
Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah, right? Also, for Bruce, in 1968, he was in the musical Star, with an exclamation point, a biopic, if you're nasty, of stage actress Gertrude Lawrence, where Julie Andrews played his daughter, despite Bruce only being 7 years older than Julie Andrews.
Classic age difference trivias. Those are some of the best.
Yep.
Forsyth, for all his charm, has lots of different camera angles where he just looks creepy and old.
Which, I mentioned The Thinker earlier.
Yes.
I forget which show it was that he hosted, but every episode would start with his profile a la Alfred Hitchcock.
Okay.
And he would be in a different pose that accentuated his chin, or he would do the Thinker pose. So yes, he took advantage. He knew about his features and used them
to be an iconic visual silhouette and spectacle.
Yeah.
Which is probably why he allowed his visage to be used in Neopets.
Yeah.
A cartoon version of Bruce Forsyth would be instantly recognizable. And then
maybe not known. Why would you think kids would
maybe he
that?
Was such a feature on, as you say, game shows, and that in rerun culture, every British kid would have known who he was and been interested in a cartoon form of him.
That's true. I'm speaking as a person who did not know who he was. Now, knowing that he hosted Strictly Come Dancing, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I guess I have seen this even older man in passing on certain things. But prior to this, yeah. Knew the name, no idea why I knew the name. According to his IMDb, he has 3 credits as a writer, 13 credits as an actor, and then 204 credits as self.
Awesome! Astonishing.
Yeah. This man has had a career of just being himself on television.
Well, let's talk about him playing himself on this show then. After his introduction, before he comes on in his first musical number, Kermit takes a moment to provide context for him by saying,
he sings, dances, plays the piano, tells jokes. In fact, he's a one-man variety show, and we're really pleased he's with us.
I thought that this was interesting and not dissimilar to what they'd done with the Candace Bergen episode, where they talked about her as being a photographer, a writer, and then those were seeded into her appearances on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, just about everything they talk about as one of the defining aspects of Forsyth's career in this intro, he then does later in the episode. He does stand up, he is a performer, he is a pianist, he does all of these things, and we're told about it briefly in that sentence at the very beginning.
Yeah.
When he then first comes back in his first musical number, where he's performing All I Need Now Is a Girl from the Sondheim musical Gypsy.
Got my tweed pressed, got my best vest. All I need now is the girl.
He's doing a little soft shoe, he's singing, and then he's interrupting himself to make jokes or riff on the situation. The situation being
that the giant bird Muppet, which according to Wikia is called Gawky Bird, is falling in love with him, which is what he doesn't want, even though he wants a bird.
British slang for girl, obviously, is a bird, but he wasn't anticipating a enormous wireframe bird. These Gawky Birds were apparently created for a stage show in Vegas with Nancy Sinatra. That the Muppets put together. And I'm about to show Pete some behind-the-scenes photographs of Henson controlling a giant armature in full light. Obviously, these are done against the classic Muppet black stage so that you can't see the performer in black or the black rods controlling them. But in this photograph that he's looking at, you can see Henson with a Muppet easily twice his height.
Yeah.
With the rods going up to his arms, and he's wearing a harness that is able to stabilize the main body of the Muppet. And then in a picture drawing opposite, you're able to see what it looks like against the black background.
That's very cool. Because, as I've mentioned before, I love the black backgrounds, trying to see the people and see how it works.
This is a very interestingly engaging set.
Mm-hmm.
The birds are vivid and neon and sort of give you the impression of being made out of pipe cleaners, mm-hmm. almost, except on a massive scale. And the set itself has a gazebo that's made out of similar bright wire neon framing. And there are vague elements on the floor and around in a tree. But it creates a really lovely contrast. It makes you almost forget about the black background, except that I'm also always trying to pick out the puppeteer against it.
Yeah.
But it really creates a very clever and evocative sense of a place without there actually being a place.
Yeah. So you brought up the gazebo.
Yeah.
It looks like a birdcage, which we'll talk about at the end
about that.
When he gets corralled into what ends up being a human cage.
Right. Yeah, so he's first surprised at the existence of the bird, then tries to get the bird off the main area so that he can dance in it.
So I kept two different stats for this,
yeah.
because there's the length of the whole sketch, but there's a period of 1 minute and 5 seconds where there's no music happening.
She'll just appear. We'll take this big bird.
I must have taken those pills. It'll go away in a minute.
When he first sees the bird, he's not sure if it's a hallucination or if she's real. And then he realizes she's real, but she's standing in the way, so he needs her to go over there. And while the bird slowly makes her way to where Bruce wants her to be, nothing happens.
Right. The music drops out as he's sort of pulling the bird by the beak and trying to get it to lift its feet. Come on, lift your feet.
Left, right, left. So 1 minute and 5 seconds of commenting and movement.
Which is surprising in and of itself, considering that most musical numbers are under 2 minutes. That this musical number has 1 minute and 5 seconds in the middle of it, and then there's going to be more at the end.
Yep. The whole thing is 3.08 minutes, and the music only is 2 minutes flat.
Interesting. So once he's got the bird back and begins his soft shoe, the bird then joins in its own way.
And Bruce seems okay with this. They do a little dance off. I'll dance, you dance. We'll then dance together. Then she chases him around. It's revealed that there's a second bird on the other side of the stage, which they then corral him into the cage-like thing.
And he yells out, "Mr. Hitchcock, Mr. Hitchcock," which I thought was a weird little birds reference, but I like the fact that now you've told me that he did parodies of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and so it's even a reference to his own career.
Yeah, that was weird. Like, I understand it, but it's also still weird to me that that's the end and that he just shouts it out. It's weird. I liked it. It's weird.
He has another very odd ad-libby comment in the middle where he's talking to the bird. He says,
"You see, I'm just going to do my song and dance number. It's the only thing I've got in the whole show. Worthwhile."
It's his first number. We've just been introduced to him, and he has an offhand comment about, A, this is the only thing I'm doing, and then he puts our mind at ease by saying, "This is the only good bit. Every time I'm going to show up after this is terrible." I thought that was an extraordinarily weird piece of tone setting.
Yeah, it was odd. It was off-putting, and it's not true, but it's one of the things I mentioned earlier about the inconsistencies of this episode. It's mostly with his bits. They're all self-referential without being connected. They reference the other bits, but then they discredit those references.
Don't think I quite understand you, but I since when we'll get to particularly the last
number where he
refers back to this number, we'll get back to that. You can explain it further then.
Okay, let's just keep going.
The next time Forsythe shows up
is in the talk spot, where
he begins by saying, "Kermit, this is a very strange show."
Yeah, and this, okay, yeah.
Again, it's about tone.
And then he calls out the fact that Kermit's a talking frog, and not real, even?
Yeah, well, it isn't like any other show on television. I mean, I'll buy the fact that you're a frog who can talk.
Well, there's nothing strange about that.
And I'll even buy the chicken who shares my dressing room.
I don't think he's claiming that Kermit is a puppet.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Just that he's a talking frog.
The fact that there would be a show full of animals that he could interact with, and that they would be... Because the sketch ends with him... Or the sketch seems like it's about to end with him talking directly to camera and saying, I told you this show was strange. Any other show would charge you two pigs for a duck. After we've had a marvelously surreal thing about bartering what the values of animals are, which we can get back to in just a second. But the basic idea then is that it's okay for him to have had a system where he would be trying to swap animals. It's just weird that the animals in this apparently can talk and are running the show. The animal commerce world is normal.
Yeah.
The fact that animals would engage in commerce while also being in charge and talking and using a dressing room, that seems to be the thing, that small hill on which he'd die.
I don't actually want to buy a chicken.
Oh, I see.
Mind you, I wouldn't mind leasing a duck.
I can let you have a duck right here. I can give you a good rental deal on this duck.
Yeah, so we get into a very strange bit where after saying, I'm sharing a dressing room with a chicken, he then does a very strange facial expression and says, however, I wouldn't mind leasing a duck. What is his intent with this duck?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah, because Kermit also says the chicken's not for sale.
Right.
Because she's married to a writer?
Member of the band.
Yes, that's right, because the coat rack is married to a writer.
Correct. But, first of all, Kermit, you shouldn't be selling anybody. But he is willing to lease the duck, and the fact that the other animals are the currency for this exchange, there's all sorts of animal rights, Muppet animal rights weirdness going on in here, not to mention the fact that there's a hierarchy of value,
yeah,
which is duck, then pig, then rat, then then chicken, then woodpecker.
Yeah, I
in terms of
intentionally didn't try and do this logic puzzle.
Okay, why?
Because I didn't really want to get into it, but for the audience, the price that Kermit wants for this duck,
yes,
is a pig and two rabbits.
Well, how much to rent this duck for a month?
For 1 month, this duck will cost you a pig and two rabbits.
Bruce doesn't have two rabbits, so he asked for change of a rat. So yes, therefore a rat is worth more than two rabbits,
but less than a pig.
Right,
but less than a duck, because a duck is worth a pig and two rabbits.
Yes, then. The change for accepting the
rat
instead of two rabbits is a woodpecker.
Correct.
So a woodpecker is worth less than a rat, which is worth less than two rabbits.
Which is worth more than two rabbits. Because otherwise he wouldn't have needed change back.
No, the rat is worth more than two rabbits, because otherwise...
What did I say?
Yeah, I don't know. You'll figure this out in the edit.
I doubt it.
Yeah, probably not.
And it used to be you could make a phone call for a woodpecker, but now you need two rabbits.
Yeah, could be. I don't know. So then, yes, as you said, Bruce then tells us, the audience, that he got a great deal because any other television show would have charged him two pigs for 1 month of duck. And then Piggy comes out.
This is the best part, though, because that feels like it's going to be the button.
Right.
And it's then Piggy delivered
crashes
like,
the stage.
Correct. And the fact that she, A, escalates... B, recognizes the weirdness of those pigs were okay as currency, but a pig is essentially one of the stars of the show, and therefore you shouldn't be just acquiring new pigs in order to get rid of the duck, who we don't get rid of because she comes back later.
Yep. Well, maybe the lease doesn't start till the first of the month.
And karate chops Bruce twice.
Yep. But also, so violently, after getting karate chopped the first time by Piggy... Bruce sticks his fingers in her nose. Piggy screams.
And then he karate chops his own hand so that it violently yanks his fingers out of her nose, causing her extra pain.
Yeah, very reminiscent of, like, the Three Stooges.
And then we cut to a unique camera angle on Statler and Waldorf. We've never seen Statler and Waldorf from this angle before. But what's even better about it is the continued background sounds of Piggy providing additional violence against Bruce Forsyth as they make their comment.
That Miss Piggy takes umbrage at the slightest annoyance.
Oh, I usually take aspirin.
Bruce is definitely not coming out as the winner in this sketch.
As well he shouldn't.
No, yeah.
Trading in pigs.
So, yeah, that's the talk spot. It's wild. It was fun, but wild.
Delving into the is it a TV show, is it a stage show, is it both, is a unanswerable enough question.
So I would say that the way to look at this and be okay with it is that it was even though it's a talk spot, and the talk spots are typically portrayed as true,
correct,
and real.
People aren't doing parts.
This is a sketch talk spot, and they're not actually trading these animals. It is all done for humor.
Which is the only way we can excuse Piggy and Bruce being civil to each other later.
Because, yeah, why would you be singing a love song to someone who just stuck their fingers in your snout and then ripped them out? How can you be in love with that man?
Yep. Yep.
But that's not the next thing we need to talk about.
It's not. We have a whole other Big Bruce segment before we get to that.
Good old Big Bruce.
Because, as we mentioned, as Fozzie says, there is an expectation in a show like this that you have a stand-up comic. Bruce Forsyth is the stand-up comic for this episode and for this show. And Kermit introduces him by saying, we're going to give Fozzie a rest this episode. Statler and Waldorf chime in by saying, it's us that you're giving a rest from him.
Yep.
So they're already well prepped to be heckling before Forsyth comes out in one of the strangest suit jackets I've ever seen. A strange navy blue checkerboard that I was both repulsed by and definitely wanted.
Didn't clock it at all.
He then spends basically the first half of this sketch doing heckler crowd work. Before able to get to his set.
Yeah, just destroys them, buries them in the box. The first thing that he says is, sir, you're old enough to have heard my jokes, Bob Hope's jokes, and Milton Berle's.
And if you've heard Milton Berle's jokes, you've heard all the jokes.
Yeah.
Milton Berle had a reputation that he encouraged of being a joke thief. That he would do anybody's joke and take credit for it.
But that's more of a heckle on Milton. Like, it is a heckle on him, on the two old men, by calling them old. Mm-hmm. But it's more a Milton Berle burn. He just goes on and just tears them apart.
He calls them old. He says that they're deaf. He says that you must have a good
blood.
Sense of humor. Oh, I like the blood
The
one.
Blood one was good, yes.
Same old stuff. We want new blood.
Yeah, well, you certainly look as though you could use some. Why don't you go to the blood bank and cash an artery?
And then ends by doing the not great joke of, I know you have an excellent sense of humor. I saw your wife.
Yep. Cool.
Minor strains of misogyny running through this one.
Tis the 70s. One more thing about the misogyny in this episode.
Yeah.
This was recorded before, but aired immediately after the Candy Bergen episode.
That's right.
Which there was a point of, this show's misogynistic, let's change that. And then the next episode they decided to air has Fozzie saying, my wife can't cook. She
burns the water.
Yeah, when boiling it. And then this. Maybe could have left another episode in there before playing this one, maybe. I don't know.
Or kept them in production order so that was a noted swing away from this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But then he goes into his actual set, which is the cultural exchange between our two countries. Mentions a bunch of shows. Hey, Pete.
Yeah?
Have you heard of the Forsyth Saga?
I have heard of the Forsyth Saga.
Have you heard of the Six Wives of Henry VIII?
No.
But you're aware of the fact that Henry VIII had six wives.
Yeah.
Upstairs, Downstairs?
I know of that show.
I'm assuming you've heard of Columbo and Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, I mean all of the American ones, of course.
Policewoman?
Okay, maybe not all of the American ones.
That was the only one I assumed you probably wouldn't have come in contact with. Angie Dickinson as policewoman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I have heard of that as being a thing. But yeah. It is the one of all of them that I've definitely never seen a frame of. Mm.
But then that is all seemingly set up to do a bunch of things about Telly Savalas being bald.
Rude.
Yeah. All kind of hacky.
Yeah.
And for it to all just be building up to comparing Telly Savalas' head to a bowling ball, as you say, rude, wasn't strong.
Yeah, it definitely should have stuck to the initial premise of what they send to us is high drama and quality, and what we send to them is trash.
Yes, because he does say it's not exactly Shakespeare, but it's just as violent.
Yep.
Which, yeah, that should have been the seed as to where the set was going.
Yeah.
But you could tell Bruce really enjoyed, because the Savalas stuff was delivered in the kind of aside tone that he used earlier when he was talking about this is the best segment I've got on this show, mm-hmm. with the Hitchcock stuff. Like, it had that kind of freewheeling, maybe not improvised, but delivered in that spontaneous tone that he was probably famous for as an entertainer.
Thank you for Kojak. He's made such a big hit in our country, and he's such a sportsman. Goes to Scotland, plays golf, and he's also a good 10-pin bowler. Got the head for it.
Yeah, I have a feeling, pure speculation,
yeah,
that he wrote this stuff, and unlike other sections, would have been provided for him.
Yeah.
He probably went, no, I'm going to do my own bit.
Which is perfectly fair.
Yeah.
But it did occur to me that he enjoys those little impish nastinesses, that's probably part of his persona.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't warm to it.
Yeah. But then,
impish nastiness is what he's here to teach Fozzie about.
It's true. And Fozzie takes to it. Because, yeah, Fozzie crashes the stage.
Hank, what's the expression? Like a chicken to water?
Yes, like a chicken to water. Fozzie interrupts, crashes the stage. Bruce then introduces Fozzie as the one and only Fozzie Bear. And then Statler and Waldorf immediately chime in and say, thank heavens there's only one.
And this is what Forsythe encourages Fozzie to use as his opportunity to try and deflect this stuff back on him.
Yep.
He says, you need to find the right retort.
Yep, all you need is a bit of pacing, a bit of timing, the right retort, the right line.
He starts off by saying, you know, not a bad entry. Hey, you guys mind? I work alone. But then immediately subverts that by saying, right, but actually I'm up here working with Mr. Forsythe, so I'm not working alone, so I don't always work alone. And undercuts his own ability to have taken that line and done something with it.
And then he does the other classic heckler retort, which is call them out for what they're wearing. You know, make them feel bad about themselves. Maybe they'll shut up. With another good line.
Yeah.
I liked this line too. Hey, is that a suit you're wearing? It's a nice one, but your wife might notice the hole in your living room rug. And then at that point, I stopped writing them down because Fozzie is just relentless. Bruce is trying to tell him to reel it in. Otherwise, he'll lose
the
audience.
Well, he starts off by saying, go for the jugular, go for the kill after the suit. And that's when he starts talking about his nose. Then it becomes clear that Fozzie is just...
he's tasted the blood. He wants more.
I really feel like there is a Rickles vibe in that, and it's just, look at me, look how nasty I can be. That's what the audience is here to laugh at.
But they're not. Not at the Muppet Show.
No.
So Bruce is right. He needs to reel it in. But then Statler and Waldorf surrender.
Yes, they wave a white flag.
Yeah, so therefore Fozzie can win. And then that cues the big musical finish where they sing side by side.
In a fairly awkward transition in that Fozzie says, I'm so glad to be able to work with you side by side. And the music starts. And Forsythe says, you've even gotten so good you can cue a big musical finish.
Yep.
The funny bit being that then when the curtain closes, Fozzie is so crazed with self-importance and glee that he pushes out through the curtain in order to get an extra bow, and Forsythe grabs him and pulls him back.
Yeah. More inconsistencies. And also, I guess it's a good thing that Fozzie never becomes a good comedian, because that would go to his head with this success.
Well, we've talked before about how Fozzie will take a very minor amount of success and say, you love me, I'm the greatest, ha ha ha. Yeah, I think a little bit of power madness goes a long way.
Yeah. And then the last big section, as we've referred to already, mm-hmm. is Bruce and Miss Piggy singing Let There Be Love.
A charting hit for Nat King Cole in 1962. Spent 14 weeks on the UK charts. I think is therefore probably the reason why Forsythe knows it and knows how to play it. Because he plays it in a way that is similar to the arrangement in the Nat King Cole version. Mm-hmm. But this song has been covered by everybody. Sammy Davis Jr., Rosemary Clooney, Frank Sinatra. He performs it in a Sinatra-esque metier. But my guess is the 62 popularity is probably what brought it to Forsythe's performance attention. Because he plays the piano very well.
Yeah, that was my thought was, he must have known this before the show, because if he learned this for this show, he's the world's greatest pianist, because he plays the hell out of this.
Let there be you. Let there be me. Let there be oysters.
On a huge Steinway, very nice looking piano. And Piggy is seated at the near camera end of the keyboard, legs crossed in full coquette pose, half singing to camera and half singing to Bruce. And Bruce is similarly turned towards her and the camera simultaneously, and them doing a duet.
Then a chorus of pigs comes in and sings back up as they sing to each other. And then at the very end of the song, Piggy does like a little vocal run.
Let there be love between Bruce and a pig. And love, 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 love.
And then Bruce at this point is like, oh no, we've taken this too far. This is all subtext. It's never... He's doing stuff with his face of like, I don't actually want
the
this.
The sketch on the dirtiest look I've ever seen. Like, again, it's weird tone. He's been having a good flirty banter. He doesn't mind the pigs coming on. He doesn't look like, oh my gosh, you guys are ruining my song. But he goes straight to, grr, I hate you for doing this. Like, he doesn't fake a big, he doesn't roll his eyes and then grin to camera. Like, he stays with the stink eye as the camera cuts.
I took the stink eye to be more, like I was saying, regret of like, oh, she's falling in love and I don't want to be in love with this pig.
Huh.
This is a song, this is a performance to me, and she has done the Miss Piggy thing of falling in love.
So soon after his violent nasal contact.
Yes, and that was the note that I had. Oh, that's the other thing, because he offhandedly during this, there's the line of birds.
There will be birds.
Yes, and then he says, hopefully little ones, not like the big one from before.
Right. Which I enjoyed.
That was a good improv.
But you talk about runners, like he's self-aware that he is part of a continuity through the episode, which I don't think we've really seen production order prior to this. Valerie Harper's episode, she gets some of that, but that happens later in production where she has a narrative throughout.
Mm-hmm. So that's the first piece of continuity in this one. The second one being that, yes, the last time these two were on stage together,
they were fighting.
Piggy was beating the hell out of him, and now she's in love with him.
Yeah,
because of this song. Again, it could be a bit, maybe it's not everything is real, but he's trying to play it off from that look of I think she's falling in love with me.
Interesting. I took it as the song was over, she was indulging in diva-esque behavior. How dare you take away from my flourish finish.
And then we have the outro
where Fozzie once again rushes on to use his newfound Don Rickles technique to call out Kermit. Because when Forsythe says, Kermit, you're a great MC, he says, yeah, MC square.
And then continues dunking on Kermit.
At which point Kermit finally says,
if you don't cut this out, you'll be cut from the show forever, basically. Yeah. Like, I have the ability to never put you on the show again.
At which point he returns to his first heckling defense technique of pleading.
Yep, grumbling, grabbing.
Gets down and pressing his chin up to Kermit's belly again and saying, oh please, Frog, oh please.
Yep. Kermit then does the typical outro, and Bruce does the Kermit arms.
Yes.
And it's weird. And we have the outro. So, some statistics.
Please.
We had 4 hits this episode, no explosions, no kisses, and 2 cute cutes. In terms of music, there was 11 minutes and 1 second of music out of 26 minutes and 28 seconds, which was 41.63% music, which is the first time we've had a repeat.
Ha!
That's exactly equal to the Paul Williams episode. So since we're halfway through, I did the math.
What the total amount of music we've seen so far in
yes,
the show?
Compared to how many minutes of show we've seen. There's been 126.76 minutes of music out of 317.79 minutes of show. So 39.89% of the first 12 episodes has been music.
So the average amount over the first half is actually significantly less than the average per episode.
Well, yes, but you can't average averages because then you get inaccurate.
Okay. Math.
You have to total and average. As someone who works in data, I yell at people all the time for doing this. Because episode 8 only had 30% music, episode 9 had 32%, those lower numbers drag down the average significantly more. Even though, yes, you are correct, almost every episode is more than 40% music. Just those few bring it down. Also, I've totaled the number of hits. So at this point, we're at 154 hits after 12 episodes. I believe we have 10 cute cutes. We have two characters eating another for the end of an episode. We have four explosions at the end as the button. We have one character dressing in a wig being revealed as the punchline, and two 1-2-3 dips. For my ranking of this episode, as we've discussed, I think Bruce is really good. He connects with the Muppets really well. He has a lot of those off-the-cuff remarks, which I really like. His bits were entertaining, but then those little inconsistencies, like all those things we've talked about through this episode. So I ranked him at 11 out of 24, just above half. I enjoyed him, but I couldn't justify putting him high. But I didn't want to put him in the bottom half either.
Who's he closest to?
Lena Horne is 10, and Jim Nabors is 14.
As always, we end the show talking about our five favorite moments in order to go out on a high note of celebrating some of the tiny details of performance, writing, or expression that deserves attention. I'm going to begin with saying that the end note of Bruce Forsyth doing the Kermit arms may have been strange, but the moment I loved is Kermit feeling self-conscious about Bruce Forsyth doing an impression. As the credits scroll up the screen, Kermit sees Forsyth doing his arms bit, puts his arms up, looks at them, looks confused, and puts them back down.
And then puts one on Fozzie's shoulder.
It's a fantastic piece of performance on Henson's part. All silent, but right in front of the camera. And just a little piece of business while the credits are rolling past.
Yep. I also had this start as well. It's a great, great moment. Sticking with Kermit,
yeah.
I had another Kermit moment. And it's also arms related. In the intro,
yes,
when he sings the special guest star thing, he's doing this swinging dance with his arms.
He's doing a weird side shuffle shimmy.
He's never done it before, and it's wonderful. Kermit's arms are the star of this episode.
During the talk spot, a thing that Kermit does that I loved, in an episode where Bruce Forsyth does a number of takes to camera, he has a number of offhand cutting remarks, there's a technique in drama and in comedy that's often talked about where you need to throw the line away. You need to absolutely not pay attention to the fact that you're delivering a humorous line at all. Kermit does that masterfully in the talk spot, wherein, as they're talking about the duck, Forsyth says, "That's a great-looking duck." Again, ignoring the idea that Forsyth wants to lease a duck for purposes unknown and then is impressed with the visuals of this duck. Things we're not talking about. Kermit then says,
"Oh, it's a great little duck. I mean, it was last owned by a little old lady who only used it as a decoy during the hunting season."
Is a fantastic riff on the old used car bit of, you know, used little old lady used to just drive it to the bank twice a year. But it's got the decoy, the duck reality of it, and he throws out that line without mugging, without barely inflection. It is the quietest, best joke in this episode.
So, this is a moment I want to highlight. the sound of the feet slapping from the gawky bird as it walks across the stage in the silence was fantastic.
Mm.
And I loved it, and I want everyone to just listen to that thwapping sound of whatever that material was.
Bring the feet, yeah, I think the tail will follow. Bring the feet, that's it, good, left, right, left, that's it, good, that's fine.
To close off the episode, I'm going to once again return to the Snurfs. There's so much inventive choreography going on in there. It's incredibly hard to talk about in an audio medium, but...
And also incredibly hard to drop audio of it in this because you still can't see, you can just hear the song.
Right. In an explanatory way, I can clip a couple of seconds of the song, but it's not going to convey just how much is going on. And the trivia track talks about the fact that there are three rods to control the Snurfs. One to control the head, and one to control each foot. And it's clear that you therefore have to do something very clever to do that, because with only two hands, and the fact that the feet are able to go back and forth in a walking motion, sometimes tapping up and down with the rhythm of the song, and sometimes in an attack formation or a flight, there's an enormous amount of activity. You can watch that sketch over and over and over again. Pick a different Snurf to focus on. It's a visual cornucopia, and I don't know who did which as a puppeteer. I think that's actually what's great about it, is you can't tell who is whom, and they're all so good. When you've got the whole row of 10, and you can picture basically the whole crowd of Muppet performers, or, as it's listed in the credits of this, Muppet people. There are a couple of different versions of the credits. The British credits almost exclusively refer to the Muppet performers as Muppet people. The American-style credits almost always refer to them as Muppet puppeteers. In this, there's been, and in the episode previous, the American credits have started to refer to them as Muppet people. And I don't know what the shift was, but it made me laugh when I finally noticed in this episode. Anyway, the puppeteers are totally anonymous against the black background, and yet each Snurf has a
personality.
Has an enormous amount of business that just keeps the sketch active and entertaining and consistently engaging. And I just wanted to re-highlight that as there isn't a specific piece of business that I want to point out, because there's just so much business that I am betraying the principle of the top five moments by saying that sketch is so full of moments, I can't pick one.
Hmm. All right, I'll allow it. Not happy about it, but I'll allow it. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cones, Yes We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam's Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomenon.
There are things, dates, facts, animal exchange rates, names, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Doc!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 10, guest starring Harvey Korman.
Yay!